Blanca threw away my little thing that goes on my mic. So we're going to have to play around. I might buzz. I'm buzzing now. I can hear myself. Okay. I can be buzzed while preaching. That's fine. It wouldn't be the first. All right. Relax. Circle. Wednesday night at my house at 7 o'clock is the drumming circle. The drumming circle is basically for all of you who are members and those of you who want to be part of the village but are not members yet, and we don't really have like a strict membership so you can be a member and not really be a member. The important part is coming to this if you're willing to invest and you're willing to be part of the community. Basically, we'll probably start out with like 10 minutes of just banging on drums because that's what it is. It's a drumming circle, sort of kind of get the vibe going. And then we'll talk about this room here, like what we're going to be able to do during the week, you know, who's going to really get keys and all that kind of stuff, and what kind of different things are we going to do in here. And also we'll probably try to answer other questions about the village and just kind of hang out and get to know each other. So that will all happen at 7 o'clock on Wednesday. And you're welcome to bring your kids. There are plenty of things at our house to do for kids, so please invite them. I have a sign-up sheet here simply to find out how many of you are going to be at it. So if you could just sign your name to that. If you don't sign your name, you can still come. We're just trying to get, you know, should I put 7 seats out or should I put 30 seats out? So, what's that? You can always bring food to a village event. It's always a good thing. Half and half is always a good idea. Bags of coffee, those kinds of things. Okay, let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for allowing us to be here. I thank you that you allow us to sing and talk about your word and be in relationship with you, and I thank you for that. And I ask that you would give us your wisdom and that you would teach us as we talk about this passage tonight. I ask all that in your name, Jesus. Amen. Last week, we talked about John chapter 14, God the Father, Jesus, the Holy Spirit. This week, we're in John chapter 15. We only have a couple more weeks, and we're going to be finished. Children, I should probably quickly say this. Here is your stuff over here, coloring stuff, passages, all that kind of stuff to do. So we're in John chapter 15. And John chapter 15 is kind of one of those passages that could be controversial. A lot of people use this passage to talk about the idea of salvation. And they kind of have developed two theologies, ways of knowing about God, about salvation. And basically, out of this passage and other passages, they've kind of said that, well, one camp says, saved, quote-unquote, and then you can never lose that salvation. No one can take you out of God's hand. And other people say, well, no, according to this passage, it looks like you could be saved and then not be saved. You get cut off and you're no longer part. And so there's these two ideas in Christianity about how our salvation works out. Now, this whole theological idea comes partly out of a story, out of a metaphor. And the danger of forming your own theology out of metaphor is that you begin to think that Jesus is an actual lamb that you can pet, that you can eat his, you know, he's a baked piece of bread that you can eat. You have to drink his blood. There's a lot of, if you start taking literally Jesus' imagery about himself, then you would believe he's a vine, that he really has a major identity crisis because he's always comparing himself to inanimate things. And so it's very dangerous for you to form a theology out of inanimate or live, you know, vegetation, unless you want a vegetation theology. So tonight, though, I think the reason we read this kind of passage this way is that we have, and this is all my opinion, by the way, this is not like doctrine that you have to live by, but I believe that we have this problem with salvation, and that we want salvation to be a point. You say, and now I'm doing the right thing, and before that I wasn't saved, and we insist that it be like that. And once we're saved, it doesn't matter. You know, we want to look at a point. Instead of thinking about salvation as something that is a relationship, an ongoing kind of thing that isn't linear, that you can't explain it in a linear sense. I can't stand up here and say who's saved and who isn't and how you got saved. Because I know from knowing your stories that a lot of you could stand up and you have a whole different story of the way you came to Christ, or the way you entered into the path of following Jesus. So it's more abstract, and it's more a relational kind of thing. So when we look at this passage in John 15 tonight, I want to skip over the whole controversy and not talk about it whatsoever, and suggest to you that this really is about a relationship with Jesus, and he is really trying to flesh that out for us. Now, this week I've been reading and thinking about joy and hope. And I realized that you can't have joy if you don't have any hope. It's pretty hard for you to be joyful if there's no hope in your life, right? And one of the major things I think that ruins hope is not having a sense of power, not having a sense or ability to impact anybody, right? If I feel like I can't impact you, that you don't respond to my interactions or what I say to you in any way, good or bad, then I feel powerless. I feel pretty hopeless. If I can't impact the world, I can't really do anything, then I'm not a very joyful person. And I think what tonight's conversation is about power, hope, and joy. And so we're going to look at those three words and ideas tonight. But let's just start in the story, or Jesus' story. And he says in chapter 15, verse 1, I am the true vine. Or some of your translations may say, I am the real vine. Now for us, that's like, great. What's like the fake vine? What does that mean? Most of us don't have that historical context. But to the Jewish people, if you walk through the Old Testament, you will find out that God and the prophets and the psalmists continually refer to Israel as a vine. Only it turns out that they rarely refer to them as a very decent vine. In fact, in Hosea it says that Israel is an empty vine, not producing any fruit. I think Isaiah talks about how Israel is a wild vine that just produces bad fruit. It produces, it's a grapevine that's untended, and so their fruit isn't rich. But the symbol of a vine for Israel has became something that was very important to them. In fact, a couple hundred years before Jesus, a guy named Maccabees stuck the vine on his coins because it was an important symbol to him. Also, in the temple there was a vine, and it was on the temple wall. I can't remember what part of the wall, but it was very... if you were wealthy and you had the money to put a grape cluster or even one grape of gold on that vine, it was something that was considered an honor to do. So the identity of Israel is wrapped up in this idea of being a vine, and really is wrapped up in this idea that their salvation comes from their nationality, the vine, that the way they're saved is that they're God's people, and that's how their salvation comes, from being Jewish and from their nationality and who they are and who God chose them to be. So Jesus, at this end of this, and you have to remember from the last couple of weeks ago, I was talking about how tense this situation is. I mean, Jesus doesn't need his divinity, he doesn't need to be God to figure out that he's going to die, that things are getting bad. He doesn't need to sort of look into the future and say, oh, I know I'm going to die on a cross. Things are looking bad. And this short little period from chapter 13 to chapter 17, Jesus is trying to really just dump his heart onto his disciples, hoping that they'll pick up some of it. And so, and you catch in chapter 13, definitely, this sense that things are a little confusing for the disciples as to what Jesus intends to do. So he tells them, I'm the true vine. So it's not your nationality, it's me. I'm the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. Okay, so what he just said is, I'm the true vine, and that everything is, if you're connected to me, then you're gonna bear fruit. But it's interesting, he says two things here. He says that dead branches are cut off, right? And that the ones that bear fruit are pruned. Now, to understand the whole thing about a grapevine, there, and even in the Old Testament you'll hear about this, but grapevines either have branches that produce fruit or don't produce fruit. And the ones that don't produce fruit, you aren't even allowed to take those once you cut them off and go to the temple and offer them as a wood offering. They are useless. They're no good to start a fire. They're no good to make twine out of. They're just useless. And so every so often in Israel, they make a big bonfire and throw these in. And so Jesus is referring, okay, so there is this dead branches that I'm going to cut off, and they're useless. And they get this. They kind of understand the story that Jesus is setting into, or at least the comparison and metaphor that he's using. So it says, you are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. Okay. Some of your versions may say abide, like abide in me, remain in me. I don't know, does anyone have tarry in me? Nobody probably has that translation. The word literally means to tarry with or to be present with. I don't know how many, like in second grade, you know, second grade sort of just like spaced out while the teacher was talking and you were in a different world. You were not present. That's kind of what this word means. That's the opposite of it is what you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be present, not somewhere else. So like some of you I can see are starting to do that. I'm asking you to abide with me for a little bit of time here. But you know what? Abiding with somebody is kind of, or continuing with somebody is kind of a mystical term. I mean, how many of you, what is it? Let's start out with just, instead of us and God, let's just talk about us as each other. What does it mean to abide with one another? Tarry, be present with each other. What does that mean? Fellowship. What does fellowship mean? Okay. Eating. Conversation. To be tuned in. Is it hard to be present with people? Or is that an easy thing to do? It's hard to be present, right? It's hard to. So, and it takes some discipline. So Jesus is saying, okay, the way that you're going to bear fruit, the way that, and having a good grape, which the kids are eating right now, is a good thing. I don't know how many of you like grapes. All right, see, so you know what I mean. To bear good fruit is good for everybody who experiences it. So he's saying, the only way this is going to happen is through me. So what he's saying to these people who are very, very wrapped up in their nationality and their identity, he's saying, you have a new identity. And being focused on Israel and Israel as God's chosen people, and that's the way you're saved, that's not going to bear any fruit. And if you read the other three Gospels, you see that Jesus is continually trying to pull people's view away from, okay, the reason that I'm saved, who I am in God has to do with my nationality, with God's choosing me, being called out. And he's saying, no, no. Now your identity really is in me. And he keeps trying to pull people's, you know, focus and saying, you know what, going down that nationality road is not going to work. And it doesn't work. Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD because they revolt. And if you read the Gospels carefully, you can hear Jesus trying to warn the people not to head in that direction. And so what he's saying is the only fruitful way is going to be for us and for the disciples to remain and tarry with. And this is why I think Jesus begins to develop kind of the definition of salvation. It's not a point in time, though you may start at a point. It literally really is a tarrying with, a being present with him, walking along the path. And so this is how you're going to bear fruit. In verse 5 it says, I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, it will be given you. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be disciples, to be my disciples. Jesus is setting up this whole identity for these people, for us. What does he keep saying? He's saying, okay, to be someone who bears fruit, you have to remain in me. Well, then he begins to tell them, then he just keeps saying it over and over again. You need to remain in me. I'm yours, you're mine, remain in me. And then he lands this thing of, ask whatever you want, and it'll be given to you. If you're on this path with me, ask, and I'll give it to you. And what's going to make me proud and make my Father proud is that you bear fruit, because you're my disciples. So go back to the first idea of power. What's going to happen with Jesus? Jesus is going to die on the cross, then he's going to raise in 3 days, and then something like 40 days later, what's he going to do? He's going to ascend into heaven. The emotional roller coaster that these disciples are going to walk through is going to be insane, and it's going to be confusing. And I think if I put myself in their place, I would feel powerless. Here I have walked with Jesus who can heal people, who can fix the blind, feed 6,000 people, pretty much do what he wants to do. Now all of a sudden, he's sort of taking this single-handed crusade on. He doesn't want me to be part of that part of the crusade. And then he raises from the dead and then leaves into the clouds. I'm going to feel somewhat disoriented. Like, what the heck is this all about? What Jesus says is, okay, what he's beginning to do is to say, I'm going to give you some power. And the power is, if you remain and tarry with me, then you can ask anything you want, and I'm going to give it to you. So you're going to have the power to have a relationship with me. And so he begins to help them form this identity as he calls them to walk with him. Verse 9 says, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made complete. So, if you have no power, you can have no joy. If you are unable to impact people or understand what the heck the person who you're following is doing, you're not going to have any joy. And to have joy, you have to have hope. And so what Jesus is doing, as I said, is he is beginning to set up for them how they're going to actually find joy. Now, the interesting thing about Jesus' path is what? To the cross. If you're a Buddhist, your job, or what you usually are called to do as a Buddhist, is move away from suffering, to come to some higher space. You want to get people to move away from suffering. As a Christian, Jesus keeps calling you into suffering. In fact, the one remarkable thing about Christianity is it's about suffering. In fact, it seems as if Jesus says that out of suffering is where joy is going to come from. And so what Jesus is saying is that if you follow me and you walk through this suffering, you are going to have an intimacy with me that allows you to ask for anything that you want, and that you will bear fruit, and that that bearing of fruit will be profitable to you and to the people around you. And that's going to make you happy. That's going to give you a full joy. But he's not offering bliss. He's just simply saying that this is going to, inner intimacy with me, you're going to have joy. Now, he says to get to this joy, he throws in that word that he keeps using all the time, love. I remained in the Father's love. You need to remain in my love. So part of this tarrying with God is coming to grips with what it means to love. And we had that huge conversation 2 weeks ago about what it meant, what love, Christian love, looked like. And so to begin to move into this joy, you actually have to, and tarry and be in relationship with God, you have to move into what it, into love and into the love of God. But then he also says there's another thing. You have to be obedient. So this whole relationship with God involves love, involves obedience, and it involves being present with Jesus. It not, you know, playing off. Now, the cool part is still to come. And he begins to talk. In verse 12 it says, "My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends. If you do what I command, I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I call you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. This is my command, love each other." So now he goes on and says, here's the exciting part, guys. If you remain in me, I'm not your master. I'm not your master. You're my friends. And I'm going to lay my life down for you. And so the exciting thing about this is that God is saying, hey, guys, Jesus is saying, you're my friends. Often, it's hard for us to comprehend what it means to be a friend of Jesus. What does that mean? I mean, words are very difficult because they begin to complicate things. If we could all just think without words, then maybe it wouldn't be so difficult in life. But what does it mean to be a friend of Jesus? Literally. What has your... Now, I don't want to hear the traditional Jesus Christian-y answers. I want to know, what has your experience been of a friendship with Jesus? What has that been like? In short, you know, what has it been like to be a friend of Jesus? If you have. What is it like? Being truly accepted. That's cool. Anyone else? Emily?
Being less part of what he's doing and flows his power through me to other people. It's really intimate.
So you have an intimate emotional experience with Jesus. Okay. Russ?
He's appreciative of the stupid little things that are really precious to my heart, you know? The things that I don't quite understand, but I really take a lot of joy in. I've sometimes experienced him just really enjoying it with him.
So you feel enjoyed. So he's really interested in who you are, even if it doesn't seem to fit in the grander picture.
Ruth?
So there's someone to go to. Gary. He knows who you are.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the acceptance.
Acceptance. middle. Go ahead.
He has the ability, even when life is in complete chaos, to just, there's still some disassemblance of peace. He brings a nurturing life. And even when everything else is done.
So there's an ability to speak through the chaos. In the back? Yeah, go ahead. So there's a commitment that he's not walking away from you. Wow.
He makes himself vulnerable.
Makes himself vulnerable.
I can say anything to him. Things that people might offend and cause them to turn away. Just say whatever's in my mind and heart. That security that is there.
What is it like? Maybe this is hard to grasp, but what is it like if somebody you really like says to you, I've chosen you to be my friend and I want to be your friend? What kind of reaction do you get from that? Run away. Too much intimacy for me. What's that? I'll call you. Right, is that a little scary? To have somebody say, well, I've just disclosed everything that I know I've told you, and I've chosen you to be my friend. That's Blanca.
He also likes surprises. He always surprises me. He sent you surprises.
So he knows you like them, and so he sent you surprises. That's very cool.
But at the same time, as
Rebecca
would say, you can tell him all of this stuff. At the same time, you have to be as open to hear what he has to say, because it's not a one-way thing. And I think that we sometimes tend to forget that God's not happy to just hear what we want to say, but he wants to say something back to us.
Well, friendship is a two-way communicating kind of thing, and Jesus.
I think along with that, being a friend of Jesus involves a measure of suffering, because I think his experience of the world is painful.
Yes. And so I'm going to jump off of that because that's where we were going. She said that, would you just say it again louder?
Jesus' experience of the world is painful. And so to be a friend to Jesus means that we bear some of that same pain.
Jesus ends this whole thing with, earlier he says that you should love one another in the way that I loved you. And then the very last thing says, and this is my command, love each other. One of the biggest killers to hope and joy are you guys and me. I mean, we kill hope and joy in people and in one another. And it's interesting that Jesus, after saying, okay, if I have a relationship with you, I've chosen you, don't worry about bearing fruit because I chose you to bear fruit. So you're going to bear fruit. But the interesting thing is that he then says, okay, now love one another. Love one another. And I've been thinking since 2 weeks ago from our conversation about that. And I realized to love someone else is to actually have to invest something in them. To actually care if something happens to them. To actually be intimately involved with each other. And what I have learned is that none of you are perfect, and neither am I. And so when I invest in you and you invest in me, you hurt me. Or you resist that investment and say, I don't want that. And so joy is killed. And what I think is that when Jesus knew that was going to happen, he knew that he was going to, his presence physically, right, was going to leave. He was going to die and then raise again and ascend. And we are going to be stuck here with this command, and as we heard last week, the Holy Spirit, to figure out how to invest in one another and how to take this relationship with God, Jesus, and then move it into one another.
Would you please define what it means, Jesus' command, bear fruit?
Mm-hmm.
Tender of the children, that he cuts off some vines and others.
Right.
But there's no vines that are left.
It's a very interesting thing, right? He says earlier on that the ones that aren't bearing fruit, he's going to cut off and throw them away. They're going to be burnt. And then in the end, he says, I've chosen you to be my friends, and you're going to bear fruit. So he...
What does that mean?
Well, I think there are two things. First, often in storytelling, Hebrew storytellers will do a both and. So he's saying that, I chose you, you're going to bear fruit. It's going to happen. The people who aren't bearing fruit, I'm going to cut off. My father's going to cut off. So that kind of is like, well, what? What are you saying? But I think what he's trying to do is put us in the tension of that conversation and not give us an answer either or. Like, it has to be people can get cut off or people can't. But... You're going to bear
fruit. Will bear fruit. Does that mean that we have a list of people that we brought to Christ or...
Okay.
What?
So you're wanting to know what fruit is?
Yes.
Okay. Well...
Maybe everybody else knows, but...
No. You're lost of fruit. All right. Well, what is fruit? Gary. I think my definition would be Gary's plus, I think, maturity. I think that if you can sit and look in the mirror and say, I have a deeper relationship with Jesus and he's impacted me. I have changed my life because Jesus is my friend, then you've borne fruit. That would be my argument.
Isn't fruit also the intimacy with God that, I mean, what Israel... was for, I mean, when they were his vine, the fruit that they would produce would be to be sweet smelling to all the nations around them. But it was also closer. So fruit is that intimate relationship with God and then being sweet savor to the people around you that everybody else went, wow, I wish our God was like that God, or I wish we could be like that. That kind of bearing.
Back then, fruit was also somewhat of a dessert.
Sure.
It was tasteful, it was refreshing in the sun, it provided nutrients, and it was something that, you know, it was a good thing. You would become a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, Jeff?
In the verse it says, he commands us to love one another.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I can love a lot of people except through Jesus. My relationship with him over the years allows me to love people that I never would have before.
Right.
But I couldn't.
Right. So it's an interesting connection between, like, being able to love people and bearing fruit. I mean, one very obvious fruit would be to be able to love people.
In my walk with God, I tried to every 5 years or so to look back. Is it any different?
Mm-hmm.
And number two, if it is any different, how is it different? Does it reflect my growth in loving him and being obedient and submissive to him and so forth and so on?
Mm-hmm.
Those, I guess in some way, that would be the fruit of the Christian life that we actually... within our really deepest soul,
mm-hmm.
be able to look and say, honestly, I've walked farther away from him. I'm not as close to God. Or I'm growing, and I know his hand is on me.
Right. I think it's good. Go ahead, and then Steve in the back.
Well, I was just going to say that the Lord said, the Bible talks about you know each other by their fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that part of our fruit is the talents and the things that we've been gifted with,
mm-hmm.
and using that,
mm-hmm.
and not it's going to vary between Christian to Christian because everybody has their own different gifts and abilities
and the, yeah, their personality and the way that they're in relationship. Steve, and then I'm going to close.
Mine's a little more Jamesy than some of the others. And that is, when I think about bearing fruit, I look at what Christ did in terms of, he talks about his relationship with the Father, then takes that next step and says our relationship with him needs to be that way. And what he did is he reached out and touched people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fruit that I've seen him bearing is not being afraid to let people around him lean on him and receive healing from him and reach into their lives and offer that. Mm-hmm. So the fruit that I see is whether or not I am willing to become relationally vulnerable, as Benny said, and also let people become vulnerable to me and touch them where they hurt and allow them to touch me where I hurt you.
That's good. Let me close with this idea. That in the chapter before, Jesus says that we're going to do greater things than him. And so that's kind of mind-boggling. Either that means collectively we're going to do greater things, or maybe we're able to do greater things. I don't know. But it's a pretty big order. And when we walk into this passage, I think what Jesus... I mean, when I was thinking about this passage, I so easily get distracted. I mean, when you think about being present, and I'm sitting with somebody just listening to them talk, it's hard for me. A lot of times my brain is just like, and then I'm like, oh, come on back here. And that's the way I am with God, in relationship with God. I have a hard time being present. Now, if I get thrown into a chaotic situation, as these disciples are thrown into, my ability to be present is going to be more difficult. And I think that Jesus knows that inbred in these people whom he called out in the Old Testament is this identity in their nationality. He knows that's going to become a distraction. And so what he's saying is, and he knows that they're going to see Jerusalem destroyed and him, you know, leaving, he's saying, okay, the way that you're going to be able to do greater things than me is remain in me. Continue to have this relationship. And as you walk with me, then whatever you ask from me, I'm going to give it to you. You're going to get it. And I'm your friend, and you're going to have a sense of joy as you walk into that, as you're loving people. And basically, all I feel like God is saying here is, I've got it figured out. I've chosen you. You're going to bear fruit. The way you're going to have power and hope is when you hang out with me. And so what you need to do is just keep moving in that direction and stay present, and you will be hopeful as you love one another. And what I think is amazing out of this is that Jesus is really saying all of this comes out of suffering because I'm going to sacrifice myself for you. As your friend, I'm going to sacrifice myself. And so this joy and this power is all going to come out of a sacrifice for me. So that's my thoughts on tonight. We're going to spend a little bit of time in meditation. We're going to hear some reading. We're going to take communion. You're welcome to come up here and take communion. Also, right back around the corner is also a place you can take communion. If you say, hey, I'm a follower of Jesus, this is what this is. It's just a public statement of saying, hey, I stand with Jesus' broken body and his blood. The sinner's chair is right there. It's not just for people who are sinning. It's just for people who want to be prayed for. And so you can go sit in that. There's going to be some music. After I pray, Emily is going to read a psalm, and then we'll spend some time listening to some music and meditation. And we'll... You are. Psalm 20. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for your love for us, your willingness to enter in our life, call us friends, to give us hope, to say that we can be in a relationship with you and that you've chosen us. And I ask that you would just bless our time of meditation, that you would bless our time of conversation.